Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Like, yeah, people do get caught up in those sorts of like details, like that kind of stuff. Like, there's that, always that discussion about like what you're, whether you're performer or artist or comedian. What do you think your moniker is?
It's funny you say that because I was listening to another podcast and it's someone who does stand up and she was talking about that, how she's like, improvisers sometimes call themselves comedians, and she's like, so then what do I do? Because it's not improv. And I find that fascinating, but I always usually say performer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason being is I never really considered myself, it's such a weird thing, I didn't get into improv because I was like, oh, I want to do comedy. I wasn't that person. I started taking improv classes and I'd done scripted theater for years, then started improv and was like, oh my gosh, this is so fun. And it was just so joyful and it felt like scripted theater to me, but totally different. And then when I started learning, I was like, oh yeah, I guess this is comedy. But because I was taught how you're not trying to be funny, you're just trying to be in the moment and listen, I always think of myself as a performer. And I always used to say, like, I'm not really funny. Like, I've never considered myself a funny person.
Yeah.
Now I think I'm funny. Improv and comedy's done that to me. But
yeah. Well, you developed a skill.
Yeah, exactly. But I definitely think I ascribe to being a performer. And I think that also has to do with the fact that I like love puppetry and I find that fascinating, and that's like something I want to explore more of. And then I love scripted theater, and it doesn't have to be comedic. And then even with improv, like, I love comedic improv, but I also like dramatic and, you know, they say more grounded, whatever that means. So I think performer kind of like captures all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's a good one. I feel like some people fear that it has... I always use it as well, just to let you know before I knock it down. but I've heard people, you know, be more upset with its genericness, like as if they feel like, you know, we're whitewashing what it is that we do.
And oh, I was like, interesting.
I don't know. I mean, I'm performing, so I'm a performer, right? When I'm a writer, I call myself a writer. When I write, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just, I have different jobs doing different kinds of things.
Well, I like how versatile it is. Like, to me, when I like saying performer versus saying just, like, comedian, what that means is I can do a lot of different things. It's not just comedy. So I like the versatility of it, but...
Usually makes me think of, like, fire dancers or, like... Or, like, the people who I knew back in the day who worked at the Coney Island Freak Show, like, they were performers. Like, I was like, she ate bugs.
Yeah.
That's a performance.
I'd be okay with that. I feel like I could be one of their tribe. That feels right to me.
Yeah. It's a good crowd.
Yeah. And like, the word artist, I feel uncomfortable with for some reason. And it's something I've been thinking a lot about because I do think a lot of the work I do, I would put... and would say it's artistic and that it's an artistic expression. But for some reason, when I say artist, it just, I feel like it sounds so snooty and it doesn't sound like me. Yeah. So, and it feels like I'm putting on airs. So performer just feels more comfy.
I do definitely use the word artist when I'm trying to elevate somebody's craft, you know, when it's like, oh, they're, you know, and not just to say that it's like, if you're an artist, you're somebody who's good at blank.
Yeah.
It's like, no, any level. It's almost like, in the way that it's funny to me that a stand-up would feel weird about another person not in stand-up saying comedian. Because I feel like stand-up and improviser are two subsets of comedian.
Yes.
Comedian is a subset of performer, and performer is a subset of artist.
Art, yeah.
So it's like... Yeah. And I mean, yeah, maybe there's visual artists. I get it. If you paint with a brush, that's maybe a little bit whatever. But like, I don't know. I mean, think about people that... are musicians, but they do it in an unorthodox way, or they like present it in a that's an artist in in their way. And then there's performance artists.
Yeah.
Though performance art, the phrase also has preconceived notions of like
black turtlenecks and berets,
weird noises and
face paint, body paints.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely stuff like that.
I got a haircut once by a guy who wore an amp on his back, and the scissors were attached to cords.
Oh, my God.
So that as he snipped your hair, it made noise.
I would be so into that.
It was great. It was a street fair.
I'm super into Arl type art. Like, I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, especially, like, looper artists. Like, what they do to me just, like, blows my mind.
Tell me what a looper artist
is.
Well,
it's someone who loops sound to create music.
Oh, okay.
So, like, Imogen Heap, I believe, is the artist's name. From Frau Frau, that band. So she's considered a looper artist. Lindsay McGowan in town is an incredible looper artist. Like, she sings, but what she does is she, like, builds tracks by recording snippets of song, or snippets of her voice, and then layers them to make harmonies and beats.
Cool.
And it's incredible, but the part of it is, like, the end product of the song is amazing, but you're seeing it in real time as they're doing it.
Oh,
kind of like DJs, shows you. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so they have the board, they create, you know, have their mic, they create the sound, they record it, they start playing it, and then they layer something on top of it, on top of it, on top of it.
Oh,
and
yep.
It's
I
so,
have seen that.
Yeah.
Right.
And Imogen Heap, a few years back, she did this thing actually during South By where she partnered with a robotics company, and they created these gloves for her so that she could create sound by movements of her hand.
Yeah,
there was this incredible article on Wired. I'll send it to you on Wired about that experience and how she did it. And her whole thing was that she was like, this is an incredible innovation, but it's all these different industries coming together to create it. So you had people in fashion, you had people in robotics, then you had the music industry all coming together to create this new thing.
Yeah.
That could be interesting for all parties, because people in fashion were like, imagine someone walking down a runway. What does a dress sound like when it has all these nodes creating sound?
Yeah.
And then you had the robotics company that are capturing information about how the hand moves.
Cool.
So that they can then teach their robotics how to better move.
Right.
And then her is a musician. She, the ability to be, not have to be hunched over on a board,
right,
but be able to look directly into the audience's face and perform a looping performance.
Wow.
Yeah, it was incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That sounds super cool. My husband makes electronic music, so he would like the gloves.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet he'd be into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He's going to be mad at me for forgetting the name of the... There's a instrument where when you, like, put your hand over it, mm-hmm, it just makes a noise.
Oh,
and I
cool.
can't remember what the name of it is.
Yeah.
He'd kill me. There's about 40 of them in the studio in the back. But yeah, he had a whole, like, when he did the electronic music, when they did it live,
mm-hmm,
he would put a few of those, like, in front. So, like, he'd be playing something on the keyboard,
yeah,
but then he'd, like, reach his hand out.
Oh, cool.
And it would just go, and it was like, oh, my God.
That's amazing. Yeah, I'm super... So cool. Super affected by sound. So, like, when I watch movies, I always notice score and sound editing.
Me too.
So that's actually, I feel like, I hate horror films. I, like, can't take them. And it has to do with, I just don't like watching violence, but...
is it the difference of the sound between
yes,
the music
it
and
is.
The talking?
It's, yeah, it's the sound. It's yeah. the sound of things. And it's not just, like, music scores, which are typically, you know, you know what that sounds like when you listen to a horror film, because they use silence a lot. But
yeah.
oftentimes they heighten the sounds of, like, doors
yeah.
and, like, glasses being set on a table.
Yeah.
And so my coping mechanism of when I want to watch a horror film is I will watch it on mute with something happy playing, watch the whole movie so I know what happens, and then go and then just watch it again. So it's like a 4 to 5 hour process for me to, like, consume a movie I actually want to see.
Oh man, watching Get Out with music in the background must have been very unusual.
I listened to, now I've forgotten the name of the First Aid Kit. I listened to one of First Aid Kit's albums while watching Get Out. To be fair, I was high, so it, like, helped.
All three of
yeah.
those things together
yeah.
sound wonderful.
It was awesome. It worked out really well. Like,
so funny.
I would recommend that for anyone. And then, yeah, then turned off that and then rewatched it and was like, this is an incredible movie.
You're like, what is happening right now?
And I had the subtitles on so I could, like, see what
oh,
people
okay.
were saying.
Oh,
but it's
okay,
just like,
that's
yeah.
And I was like, wow, what a visual experience and then an audio experience. Did you then see, and I haven't seen it,
yeah.
so I have no information
yeah.
truly, but there's that John Krasinski movie that came out, A Quiet Place.
Oh, so it hasn't come out. so that I can do it yet, but I will.
Right, because it was in the movie mm-hmm. theater. Yeah, yeah.
I 100% have plans to do that.
Well, because if I understand correctly, and I don't 100% yeah. don't know anything about it, except yeah. for
the trailer,
that
yeah.
they talk about the idea that, well, there was a lot of articles about sound.
Yeah.
And I didn't read them because I didn't want to get spoilers, but I was interested because I was like, ooh, my husband does sound, and so yeah. when I see something about that, I'll be like, hey, babe, let's watch this movie.
Cause yeah.
then something for him, something for me.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I can look at John Krasinski and go, hmm. And he can, you know, look and go like, oh, you see that noise right there? That was from a book. You know, I'm like, cool, tell me about it. But from what I understand, it's silent.
Yeah,
like
a it's lot pretty of absent silence. Of sound.
Yeah.
But, which is terrifying. So, I mean, like, oh, yeah, yeah. like I've read so much about just how the absence, well, have you ever seen There Will Be Blood?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. So there's some pretty intense scenes in that movie, mm-hmm. and if oftentimes they begin silently, and then the music slowly trickles in, and it's like during the moments of tension.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like super impactful, and that's how a lot of horror is as well. But yeah, I've already decided. Yeah, Quiet Place. I really want to see it, mm-hmm. but I am going to listen to some sort of album on top of it, like mm-hmm. Simon and Garfunkel or something.
Interesting.
So I can like cope yeah. with it, and then I'll turn that off and then rewatch it.
You know, I always find that not only horror movies, but every movie, yeah. like action movies especially too.
Yeah.
The sound of the shooting and explosions is super loud, and the yeah. music is super loud. But then when they talk, it's like a whisper situation. You're like, what's happening?
I don't understand how mixing can be so bad. I don't.
Yeah, I don't understand yeah. why that's a thing. Like, because I understand that they don't want the people to be super loud.
Yeah.
I get it. And I also understand because I am a live theater girl, and the first few times I did film,
mm-hmm.
I was told to quiet down. But yeah, I mean, film is just about whispering really close to a human. And it was like my favorite part about doing film was learning how awkwardly close you stand to another human being.
Oh my God, really?
Like the conversations, because it's like we're having this conversation, we're quite close to each other.
Yeah.
But if they were filming it, they'd like push me right into this spot.
That's so funny.
Just so they can get the angles
yeah.
of our faces close to each other. But it's like, why are we so, and that's why people are whispering. Because they're so close to one another.
They don't have to.
They don't have to be loud.
And that's so fascinating.
But you'd think a person who's the sound editor could at least bring up the volume right after the explosion. My ears are ringing
yes.
from 47 guns going off and murdering the person we wanted them to murder, I guess. But then we go to the next scene and they're like, listen, it's really important. We talk about the reason why we shot those people.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, what did I say? And my hearing is terrible
yeah.
to begin with.
Yeah.
Like, thank God my husband's in sound. His hearing is good.
Good.
But he hears, like, a pin drop 40 miles away,
yeah.
which is not helpful for neighbors. You know,
oh,
like, the
gosh.
Neighbors have a party or somebody sitting outside in their car playing music,
mm-hmm.
and he hears it, and I'm like, I don't hear anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there's nothing going on. That's
yeah.
why I'm like, I lived in New York City and was like, it's kind of quiet, right? Like,
it's kind of a small town here.
Yeah, it seems so.
Quote.
Cozy.
It's cozy.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
But yeah, sound is, it's so weird in movies how they like don't
yeah.
even them out.
Don't even them out. And although that's 100% true. It's kind of like that whole, you know, they're allowed there for a long time. They were allowed to pump up commercials to be louder whenever
oh,
this
yeah.
come on. But then there was that act that during the Obama administration that
now they're all quiet.
Yeah, that they get fined if they pump up the volume.
Huh.
So some channels still do it. It's just they get fined for it. That's a fun fact.
Well, the only time I ever watch commercials is on Hulu because we don't have cable or anything.
Yeah.
I mean, we have antenna, but we don't really watch it.
Yeah.
Everything that we
consume,
even the stuff from that we were watching on the antenna, we eventually became available on like Amazon or
yeah.
Netflix. So it was like, eh, why are we doing this?
But
commercials on
yeah.
Hulu will sometimes be super quiet,
mm.
and it's almost more distracting.
Yeah.
Like, it's like,
notice the absence.
I'll see the commercials coming on, so I kind of don't pay attention, but then I'm like, well, what is it about? Because I can't hear anything. And I was like, is the computer glitching? Oh, no, they're telling me to buy Tide real quiet.
Real quietly. Real polite.
Real quiet.
They're a real polite company.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
But, yeah, I mean, it's It is interesting that the regulations like that, it never occurred to me that that would be a thing, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that makes total sense.
Consumers complained about it enough, and then finally, and I have no idea the history about it. I just remember, of all things, being on Yahoo Answers and coming across someone who complained that they're like, has Obama done anything? And someone cited that particular act of like, this was passed in her administration. And I'm just like, of all the things, this is the thing you care about? But okay.
Hey.
Yeah.
People are wild about the very specific things that they're obsessed with.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. People have soapboxes, and sometimes they're the tiniest soapboxes, but they get right up on them.
Oh my goodness. It's just so funny. But yeah. But yeah.
Oh man. Oh, so, you were talking about your introduction into improv, but I'd love to hear about your, before that, I'd love to hear about your, like, scripted plays. How did you get into theater initially, and then take me through the journey to improv?
Sure. So, so I grew up in a small town in East Texas called Madisonville, and I was a theater kid. Did theater from, you know, age four on. Doing church plays and school plays, all of that. My town is super conservative, so imagine Footloose, and that's literally what it was like, because it was a dry county run by Baptists, so there was no dancing, very racist. So theater was kind of my, like, thing that motivated me so much and was the thing that really exposed me to the arts, and I come kind of from an artistic family. My grandmother is a sculptor and a painter, and then my uncle Matt, his name is Matthew Posey, and he's an actor, and he lives in Dallas and has owned several theaters throughout the years, but right now owns Ochre House, and then before that he owned the Bijou, and the Bijou existed kind of like in the 80s and 90s, and I was just in love with it, and he like dated a ballerina at one point, and I was like, I just want to be an actor so badly.
Is Madisonville, is that the name of it, near Dallas?
No, it's near College Station.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's like halfway between Houston and Dallas. It's right a on. Truck stop town at the intersection of 45 and 21.
Very nice.
It has a really nice Buc-ee's now.
Of course it does.
That didn't exist when I was growing up there, but...
No, Buc-ee's finds the town.
Yeah, it does. It does. So lots of
people think Amazon's taken over, but it's Buc-ee's or secretly Jeff Bezos owns Buc-ee's.
Yeah, there you go.
One of those two things.
There you go. So then in high school, I mean, that's what I really wanted to be an actor, and that's what I decided I wanted to do. And so then my junior year of high school, my parents were like, why don't you go work in your uncle's theater for a summer? And I was like, okay, I'll go do that. So,
is he much, much older than you?
He is. So he is, oh gosh, my parents are 60, so I think he's 55. But he still dates people my age. Zing.
Hey man, you're single when you're single.
Yeah, exactly. But he was always very supportive and very like, encouraging and also, yeah, just very encouraging and especially... As an actor who he very much valued education, he went to, he went to a school in California and studied theater and really, like, loved his education. So he was very much encouraging of that. So I worked for his theater, at the time, I think it was called the Bijou, for a hot sec, like 2 weeks, and which was, an eternity when you're 17, and it felt great. But the thing I learned was I was like, ooh, I'm a Virgo, and I'm pretty grounded, and I'm driving all these actors crazy, because I was, like, a stage manager, and I was super detailed, and I'm talking to these people about their lives, and what do they do, and I got really scared of, like, oh my gosh, well, I work in a coffee shop for the rest of my life, and especially because the people who were working there, yeah, they were professional actors, but, you know, still have to pay the bills when they're in between gigs and things.
Yeah.
So I kind of lost my ambition to do it, which makes me really sad now because I'm like, okay, you just got scared a little bit.
Also, I would like to say, like, out loud to audience, to people in general, that I really think there are worse things than being a coffee shop barista.
Oh my gosh!
Life.
Well, what's hilarious is I'm between jobs right now, and I actually got laid off from my tech job that I had.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's life. Yeah. And one of the things I'm exploring is, I'm like, I've never been a barista. I've always wanted to know what it's like. And that's a thing I'm looking into because yeah. I'm like, I've never done it. And I've always wanted to do it. And
Starbucks has health insurance and discounts.
I know. I mean,
yeah. All I want to do is drink coffee and go to the doctor. These are all my interests.
Exactly. Exactly. But when you're 17, you have an idea you're of right. what life is. And that's right, the thing yeah. that's really hard. And I wish, and that's where I wish I could go back to my 17-year-old self and be like, you don't have it figured out. Wanting to have a house and be married and have kids and all that, that's all great, but you don't have to have that figured out by 25. Yeah. Like, you have time and you will be supported. And the thing is when you pursue these other things that are more safe, quote unquote, of, you know, a steady paycheck and the ability to give you extra money, you are having to give up something, which mm-hmm. is doing the things you love.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's that balance. And so that's, and what's hard is, I think growing up in a small town, the only role model I had who wasn't doing what would, I guess, be considered conventional life when I was 17 was my Uncle Matt. But the way my parents talked about him and the way my family talked about him is like, he was living this wild life. Well, now I look at him like, no, he's working his ass off and yeah. doing the thing he loves. Yeah. And that is super admirable. And, but I was young and it just seemed scary. And so,
yeah, it's hard. Plus, yeah. I bet you even if you told 17-year-old you wouldn't listen.
Exactly. Because you think you have it figured out.
I mean, but that's the case with everything.
Yeah.
Where, like, when you get at certain points in your life, you really think you have it figured out. And sometimes you do. For your period of time, you know, mm-hmm. you do. You know what you want to do. You're ready to head on to the next thing. The only reason why I'm, like, so adamant about, like, oh, it's not the worst life
yeah.
is that I actually, I come from a place of privilege,
mm-hmm.
but I've had ups and downs where I've had stuff and then I didn't have stuff.
Yeah.
And when I was in my mid-20s, I was having a tough time, called my mom,
mm-hmm.
and she was like, you need to stop living your life like you're middle class and start living like you're poor, because yeah. I'm really sorry, but you are.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh. So I sort of had to realign what was important, and then it occurred to me that, like, there's these rules set by no one I care about that say you have to do A, B, and C in your life. And you could do anything. There's no like, there are people who never have a job.
Yeah.
Like, one of the funny things, and people roll their eyes about it, but, like, Jerry Seinfeld always talks about how he never had another job.
Yeah.
And I find that very admirable. Now,
yeah.
he hit success early in his life so that buoyed him. He never had to.
Yeah.
But, you know, he could have, but he tried so hard
yes.
to do these things. And he yeah. put all this effort. And I'm sure he ate Spam out of a can
exactly.
1,000 times because he was like, well, I don't, you know, all I got is this, you know.
That's all you
got
to do.
And it's like, there are indignities in every possible path.
Yeah.
There is an indignity to having a lot of money. There's an indignity to having no money.
Yeah.
And, like, you just sort of have to be cool with whatever it might be. Other thing, too, is wouldn't you be happy if when you went to a service job, someone was happy and enjoyed their life?
Oh, my God.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes. Well, I think it's those. I mean, you hit it on the head for me of unwritten rules. I yeah. think, like, I feel like I had an awakening in my late 20s of, like, I am living my life as though someone told me I had to do these things. I don't have to do these things.
Yeah.
I can do the things I want to do. But it's like you have. For me, I have, like, these inner conflicts of, oh, God, am I allowed to? Is this okay? And worrying about judgment and all of that. And then, yeah, getting over it and being like, no, this is all made up. All of this is made up. And, yeah, I completely agree. And I've heard people kind of, you know, scoff when people try and, like, move to other cities to make it or whatever they're seeking. And I have so much pride for those people. I mean, that's so vulnerable and hard to really say, like, this is what I'm doing. I'm putting it all on the line and being willing to quote unquote fail. And also success and how we define it is so frustrating.
Yep.
I had this conversation with my dad, and he's a veterinarian, and owned a practice, and, you know, that's been his life. And now he's in academia and teaches, for a vet school. And you know, we talk about comedy and what I'm doing, and he's like, well, you ever thought about going to LA? Do you ever think about doing these things? And I was like, and he goes, you know, I just feel like if you really want to be successful at it. And I was like, well, I think that's where we have to stop, because your idea of success and my idea of success are probably different. And he's like, because for him, he thinks it's fame. And I was like, no, I just want to be able to do this forever. That's what I want to do. That's
well,
success.
Well, you can, just so you know.
Yeah. And I'm already in it. Yeah. Like, I set, you know, it's like I had set goals for myself. And now those goals change. But even then, they're still, like, within reach. And I don't know. That's how I feel about it. I'm like, I will... Fame is such a scary beast to, I think, to pursue from my point of view. Other people may feel differently, but for me...
it seems very frightening.
I'm afraid of what it would do to me.
Especially right now.
Yeah, and I'm terrified of what it would do to me. I'm very vain, and so... my entourage would hate me.
If I get a full team to really make this bod a bod, it's over. It's over. I've been hiding underneath these layers of fat for years. If I got professionals,
oh man.
I'm so sorry.
What's funny though is I don't care how famous I will ever become. I will be a McDonald's girl till the day I die. you can keep your Chick-fil-A and your Fly-Rite. I want a terrible... McNuggets with hot mustard sauce, and that'll never change. That's who I am inside.
I was addicted early, and yeah, I'm sticking to it.
It was our only fast food in my hometown for a really long time. Yeah. So it feels like a luxury to eat it.
Oh man. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so I hate when people talk about sick, or no, I don't hate it, but I am very skeptical when people start judging what is someone else's success.
Yeah, because, that I think is the most important part.
Because yeah, because everyone defines it differently. And it's like I even look at, you know, filmmaking, and people talk about, like, well, she's really successful, but they're talking about fame. They're not, like, just because you don't know the script writer for this, you know, television show, doesn't mean she's not successful. She is successful. She's making a television show.
I was listening to this podcast a while back with the writers from GLOW.
Okay.
And one of the gals was talking about how she had sold upwards of 30 scripts.
Oh, wow.
And lived off of that money.
Yeah.
But 0% of them were made.
Yeah.
They took them. They shelved them.
Yep.
They didn't do anything with them. But she's fine. She has an apartment.
Yeah.
She can pay her bills. She's got an active job right now.
Oh, my gosh.
And to my mind, she's successful. To my mind, the first time she sold the script, she was successful.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. But at the same time, she has this continued success. She's doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
She's part of the industry she wants to be part of. Yet no one knows her name.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows all of the 30 plus. Imagine 30 things you've written no one can ever do anything with.
I know. That's,
isn't that wild? They buy them and then no one, you can't do anything.
Yeah, that's
forever.
Crazy. That's crazy. But you know what's crazy?
It's
like,
crazy.
We don't know her name, but man, I bet you that there's someone in her community that looks at her and is just like, man, I want to be her.
Oh, exactly.
You know,
I mean?
I
want to be her too. Even I can't remember her name.
Yeah. But yeah. I think, I mean, and that's part of it, is like this false idea of success is like, I think even within our community, within improv and in comedy, there are people I look at within the community that I'm like, oh, I want to be them. They're so good. And it's like, they're just like me. They're just creating and doing their thing. But we do this, I don't know, like, idea of sometimes like that they're doing more, or they're somehow, you know, have that special sauce, which sometimes that's what it is. But I don't know, there's something exciting about that, and I wish we reveled in that, of like celebrating the colleague's success. And I think we do.
Oh,
it, but it's also hard because it's like you have to check your own ego and
it's really tough.
Yeah.
I feel like the everybody's a unique snowflake is coming to bite us in the ass real hard right now, like society-wise. And everybody, so like the internet makes everyone feel like everything that they say is important and great.
Yeah.
And it's not.
Yeah.
And, but the problem is that like some people are being drowned out. People who have talent. I really think that it's sort of like the nature of... It's like when a person's on an upswing, you can kind of feel it with them. When they're not, you know, they're just a person, they're your friend, that you talk to them, whatever, but they don't shine like a diamond.
Yeah.
But sometimes people can do really great things. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to say positive things because, like I was saying with the internet, there's something really negative about that.
Yeah.
The internet is just chock full of people who think that what they have to say is the best mm-hmm. and everybody around them is the worst. Mm-hmm. And I really just think that we need to appreciate us all as a whole.
Oh, yeah.
Like, isn't it cool that in the same town there are three scripted improvised things going on, and yet there's this other thing that was totally written by this girl that I know, and then yeah. another thing that yeah. was made. Like, it's just, you know, and then even, like, this guy's doing a, you know, Brecht play. He's super yeah. into it. Like, it's wonderful. This they're doing kids stuff at Zach, you know. It no matter what it is, no matter what kind of thing you're doing, like, it's really, it's really important, and we need to appreciate those people.
Well, and especially because it's vulnerable. I think the thing that yeah. I get frustrated with, and I have, it's like, I feel like every person should have to experience doing like an improv 101 class almost, or something where you yeah. have to put yourself out there, and you have to say or do a thing that's inside of you, and then you have to put it out there for someone else to judge or whatever. And in improv 101, we teach people, of course, to yes and it and support it, and that there are no bad ideas. But that feeling, that vulnerable feeling, what I want to tell people is, can you imagine carrying a piece of art inside of you for years and then finally getting it out, putting all that work, sweat, and tears into it, and you put it out there? That in itself is such a testament to your strength of will and discipline, your ability to check your own ego, all these different things. You put it out, and whether or not it's great, the act of putting it out is such a something that to be appreciated. Now, then there is like the whole idea is like, was it worthwhile? Is it changing society? All these other things. And those are things that are important to looking at art and how it's changing the world, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes I just want to like all of us, but can we all just take a break for a second and say, thank you for putting out your vulnerability, because my gosh, is it hard?
Yeah.
And I feel like the people who have the megaphone of criticism are the people not creating anything. And that's where whenever I go see a play, especially if it's a new work, and people are just immediate to like tear it to shreds, I just want to say, what have you written? What have you put out? Because if you put out something, I think you'll be critical, but there will be a level of empathy of like, I don't need to rip this to shreds. I can say, I appreciated this about it. Yeah. I appreciated this thing.
You know what, though? I was recently reading about the idea that we live in our own little bubbles. And mm-hmm. I think we live in the loveliest of bubbles, mm-hmm. which is improvisers.
Yeah.
And people who are don't just take a 101 class, but continue to do improv, mm-hmm. embrace a kindness in their heart and soul that other people can't or don't.
Yeah.
And because I'm surrounded by that, there is something positive and lovely and wonderful about it. Mm-hmm. And then I forget that the world around us is not so sweet and kind, and they can't see what's going on. Like, mm-hmm. like when I see such vitriol on the internet, sometimes mm-hmm. I'm like, but when you have these people around you, how can you do that? But they don't. They're yeah. alone. They don't have a community.
Yeah.
We're lucky just to have these people around us to like or dislike, never mind, you know, how that goes. And mm-hmm. I love teaching Improv 1. It's my favorite. Mm-hmm. It's my favorite because I can hold that vulnerability in my hand and tell them they're safe.
Yeah.
Like, the thing that's so important to me is getting people into this beautiful world.
Yeah, it's like the light bulb comes on where they're like, wait, what? I can do something and it not be at the detriment of my own, like, what people think of me. Like,
yeah.
To give people permission to be, no, just be yourself. Do the thing that comes to mind. You're like, wait, what? I have all these filters that I've built for years and years and years to make sure I say the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, when I'm teaching level one, because it's so early,
yeah.
and it's like, you have no ability in this, so I am going to deal with it this way, I will take any possible idea,
yeah.
suggestion, whatever it might be, just to get them out.
Yeah.
Just to say words. I go, like on the first or second day or whatever, I'll be like, just have conversations with each other. You don't know each other.
Yeah.
I was like, just meet this person you're talking to. Like, yeah, know, whatever. I go, I know that I told you not to ask questions, but, you know, throw in some info. They'll throw some back. Yeah. How about that? Tell them about yourself. I'm from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You know, oh, really? I've never been to Milwaukee. You know, yeah. Like, great. And now you're having a conversation. And this is an improv scene. Why? Because you had a conversation. And they're like, that's all I needed to do?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah. Yeah, that's all you it's needed crazy. To do.
I'll always remember, it's funny because I kind of didn't get to how I got to improv. I didn't answer your question
well,
earlier.
We'll get there.
We'll get there eventually. But
it's in my head. I'll get it.
I will always remember, for me, like, a change. So I took improv kind of on a whim. I had moved back.
Don't we all?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had been living in Minneapolis for 4 years and had just moved back. Oh. Yeah, I lived there for 4 years.
What's that like?
It was great. I loved Minneapolis. It's
like lots of great theater.
Yeah, they do. So they have a lot of great live theater. And
yeah, I have a theater. I'm a theater major in college, okay. So I'm fully entrenched.
Yeah.
And also they made us study all the major cities
That
had regional theaters.
Well, it has
so tell me about that.
Yeah, the second largest amount of theater in the country, second to New York, is Minneapolis. Yeah, right. Yeah, there's that many. So I didn't do, what's funny is I actually didn't do much scripted there because it was very competitive. From the community perspective. Yeah. But I did a lot of volunteering. So I worked at the children's theater there and helped with their events and then did lots of random things of like organizing wardrobe closets. And then like whenever they would do fittings for their big productions, they'd always need volunteers to help wrangle kids. So I did that. And then with the Orpheum Theater, oh man, I auditioned for so many plays. But again, I just kind of volunteered to try and get in with the community. And I kind of started late, though. I was there for 4 years, but it was really only after my, I guess, like, second year of living there that I started trying to, like, get in. Hmm. But
why
I
did you go to Minneapolis?
Why did I move there? Or yeah. What? So, I moved there for a boy. I had been living in Austin, gone to school here, and then I had a job, but I really hated it. And then my boyfriend at the time moved up there because he was in advertising and was recruited by an agency. So then I moved up there. Fun. Yeah, I moved up there to be with him. And I actually had a job, but then the recession happened and I got laid off. Hmm. And so then I did a bunch of other jobs, just, you know, figuring out what I wanted to do. And I was pretty young. I was in my early 20s.
Volunteering at all these other
places. I tried social. Like, I worked at this place called the Dignity Center, which was like a social work branch of a church, seeing if I want to go into social work, which was really cool. I found out I didn't, but I'm thankful for the experience. And then I worked for the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra for a period.
Whoa.
Yeah, so just kind of did a bunch of different things.
And was it mostly, like, organizational stuff? You mentioned earlier your stage manager-y brain,
So as far as, like, with them, I was doing PR. So that was what I studied in college, is public relations. And then my first job out of college was a marketing position. So I did mostly marketing-y things, but like for the Orpheum it was like stage management, and then for St. Paul Chamber Orchestra I did PR type things, but also a lot of event management. I have a lot of event coordination experience, and then also that's theater cool. Kind of like teaches you how to do that too, I feel like.
Sure.
Even like doing productions in high school, I feel like it teaches you like how do you welcome people and what's the flow of traffic into the theater space and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Bless your heart to believe that anyone other than stage manager minds have the ability to do that.
It always, like, amazes, because my mind just goes there naturally, like, when I go to events where I'm like, why would someone put a table here? This is terrible traffic. Also, it's, like, it's probably a fire code hazard. And
yep.
Like, I think that way.
Oh my god, me too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But when I moved back to Austin, I really wanted to get back into scripted theater, because before I had left, I had started doing a lot of scripted here, and mostly at the at a Leander Community Theater. I think it was called the Way Off Broadway Players. I was in two or three plays up there. It was really fun. They were all Agatha Christie plays, and I really liked them a lot.
Agatha Christie.
Yeah, I know.
I love it.
Who done it? It was great.
Yeah, that's cool. I've done dinner theater.
Yeah, exactly. And so
this is like legit.
Yeah, I moved back and saw. I was in the Hideout Coffee House and saw like an advertisement for improv, and I was like, I don't really know what this is, but it's free, and it's for, you know, it's one evening. I'll check it out. And so I did it, and I was like, I basically laughed for 3 hours. This was so fun. and then started taking classes and then just got addicted. And I think because I was a theater kid, like, going to Hideout Productions just really tickled me because I loved all the costumes and the lighting and just kind of the production of it.
Yeah.
But then whenever I got into improv, I actually did a lot more at Coal Town than anywhere else initially, and then kind of started doing stuff more at Hideout and Institution. And
you did classes at Hideout?
I did.
You did shows and stuff with troops at Coal Town?
Not with troops. So my first show I was ever in was a Frank Nesher show, and it was called It's Saturday Night. And it was, half improvised and half sketch. Because I do write sketch, and I enjoy doing that. Kind of done it on and off the last few years. So that was, the first show I was in. Oh, I guess I was in a student show at Hideout. I was in Camp Made Up on the Spot, which was directed by John Bolden. I forgot about that one.
It's funny how you, like, side in the sketch comedy writing, too.
Yeah.
And no, because I was thinking about our conversation about performer. And I feel exactly the same way, where it's, I would say I'm a performer.
Yeah.
But primarily right now, anyway.
Yeah.
All I do is write.
Well.
And it's like, I guess. But sketch comedy writing is such a specific, like.
It is.
It's focused on performing.
Yes.
So it's like, and it's. For me, it's like, I write for a show,
mm-hmm.
and then I just put it in the folder. And it's like,
yeah,
and so I never look at it again.
I am so similar. So my thing and the thing I've landed on is I tend to write for a performer versus, like, a show concept. Yeah. Like, so I had done a lot of work with Anything Live over at Institution.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group I was part of. We call ourselves, like, the Anything Collective, where we would get together and do writers groups and come up with these bits that we put up just for the week, or sometimes they'd be running, you know, that kind of thing. But the thing I found is when we get all together, I'm like, oh, I know you as a performer. I know what you do on stage when you improvise or when you're just being yourself. I'm going to create a character that's just you exaggerated. And, like, and I just found I get so inspired by it that's how I've tended to write of late. But yeah, I love sketch. It's so fun. But it is such it cracks me up how you can write something and then you put it in the actual person who's going to be performing it's hands, and how they'll emphasize a certain syllable, or they'll just say it a little differently, and it can just completely kill a joke, or, like, you're like, okay, well, now that doesn't make any sense. And it's so funny, and I love it so much.
It is super interesting. Also, you can do a scene with your troupe, everyone could be laughing hilariously, and then when you put it in front of an audience, it's crickets.
I gotta tell you, that's actually the thing that kills me, I will say, about sketch, that is, like, to me, disheartening. Of with improv, right, you can, like, have warmed up, get on stage, and you're making things up on the spot, and you kill. Then you have a sketch that you've been toiling on for 2 months. You have it perfected. Everybody has it memorized. We know the beats. We know when the laughs are supposed to happen. Put them from an audience. Yeah. And nothing.
Yeah.
And it is so heartbreaking.
Very much so.
It's so heartbreaking to me.
Yeah.
And then you could do the exact same sketch the exact same way, and for whatever reason, that audience loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Or it's just you waited a half beat longer to deliver a line, and that's what made it kill. You know?
Yeah.
It is
mind-blowing sometimes.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I feel like when I think about comedy generally, I think sketch is, it's one that I look at that, man, there is just so much that goes into it, so much work, and I don't know, I really respect it whenever it's, like, really, really good, because I'm like, there's so much to this that's mystery and luck, and also so much hard work, and,
It's crazy how even in this town, there are different audiences. Like you're saying, like, mm-hmm. night to night is that way.
Oh, yeah.
And you're totally right. Even in the same venue, I've had the neighborhood do, you know, 2 or 3 weekends, and we have different audiences, and they mm-hmm. laugh at different stuff, and we're like, just go with it. And then beginning of the year, I had 1 month where I did one show at Hideout and one show at Fallout.
Oh,
and
that's right.
And I was like, because I didn't know it was going to happen. And
yeah,
I was like, I was like, okay, I have a team and we need to keep working to keep our heads above water.
Yeah.
So anyway, we did the show there. The audience at the Hideout laughed at very specific, unusual things.
Yes.
No one knew what they were laughing or how they connected the ideas in their heads or what made them laugh. And then when we went to Fallout, totally different things.
That's so
entirely because we like, and they didn't react as intensely as we expected them to at the hideout, but they were paying attention. Yeah. And I was like, hey guys, they listened. Okay. Yeah. I don't, you know, like maybe they didn't give us big guffaws like we were hoping at different spots, but they were in it.
Yeah.
No one was talking. There wasn't like anyone on their phone. Like they were part of the experience. They just didn't laugh out loud. You know, maybe that's just fun, you know?
Well, and it's like, I had this the other day I was talking with a friend and we were, well, Ann Simmons from Physics Curse, which is the troupe I'm in. We've been together like almost 4 years, I guess.
Oh.
So they're my main improv troupe. But she and I were talking about like, would you rather? And it was, would you rather be the cold opener on a Monday night? Or would you rather be the closing act on a Thursday night, but the show's been going long? And so that's a great question, right? That's a
great question.
And it's like, oh, I don't know. I was like, Monday night, you know, these people are coming out of work. They have a full week ahead. They're probably not drinking that hard. But they're here to see comedy. So, you know, they didn't stumble off the street thinking like, oh, what is this? It's like they usually have sought it out. Where it was like, on a Thursday night, they could have gone and been drinking and then walked by and saw this comedy and stumbled in. And then the show is going long.
Yeah.
It's like, but you're also the headliner, so it's a hard one.
It's funny. Basically, because you said cold open, like if I have the preconceived notion that I can be cold, then I'll do Monday all day. Like, if I don't, the cold open has to make them interested to stick around, but they don't have to laugh.
Yeah, they don't have to laugh.
So,
done. I actually feel like that's then, as far as like improv training, I'm so thankful for. So, Physics Curse. We used to be the opener for Date Night, the monthly slot at Hideout. And we had that slot for over a year, I guess like a year and a half. And it was us, the troupe, the escorts, and then the Knuckleball Now are the headliners. And that was always the order. Every month, that was the deal. And so we've gotten so good. We're so used to being the opening troupe and to warming up a crowd. Like, we're so used to it. But now we have a monthly show that we do, and we're the headliner. And then we do other shows, and we're just like, they're applauding and laughing. Like, they love us. Like, we're so used to silence and, like, a few chuckles that now we're just, it's like, it feels like we're being warmed home or something. Welcomed home.
Yeah, it's crazy how fickle laughter can be from an audience. Because, I mean, it depends on 1,000 things. Like, you're saying those two examples are, like, just specific days of the week. Never mind... like these individuals, what's going on, what the theater has going on, what the other performers might be doing, what the content of what your joke is.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much to balance, so many balls to juggle to make a show go well.
Yeah. I gotta say, as a performer, I feel like I'm a little, like, I want there to be laughter. I want them to have a good time. But I am very hesitant to be like, the show is good based on the amount of laughter we got. Like, I feel like that's a dangerous game. Mm-hmm. And especially because for me, my own sensibilities, like, I don't want us to chase laughter at all.
Yeah.
If anything, I'd rather there be less of it. But when it happens, it be like really big. You know, and to me that means like, oh, they're engaged and they're listening.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're giving the payout. And so I get nervous when I play with performers who I can tell, like, are used to the laughter, and that's reassuring, because then I'm like, oh, I'm not going to help you. I'm not funny. Like, I can be a straight man. What do you want?
You need to be funny.
Yeah. I'm here for you. But, I'm wary of laughter. I don't know.
I have a difficult relationship with the audience for sure.
Yeah.
Because when I run my show, I have to play two different roles. One is, I am, trying to create a show that I think an audience will like, and I tell an audience, hey, you should come to our show because it's real great. And you're going to have a fun time. You're going to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm selling that to both the performers and the audience. Oh, it's going to be a good time. But if everybody isn't immediately satisfied by that, I have to keep the actors from jumping ship.
Yeah.
So after shows that don't go well, I have to be like, they didn't get it, guys. It's fine.
Yeah.
They weren't with us. That we just weren't on the same wavelength. Yep. It's not you. Da da da.
Yeah.
Like, and I've been like, forget them. Who cares? Who cares what they think? And people will be like, you just hate the audience. I'm like, no, it's not that I hate the audience. I mean, sometimes I do. When we do a fucking gold sketch and we get nothing, I'm like, they're brainless. They don't understand. We all know. But sometimes it's like, you know, we could have done better. Mm-hmm. And I know that. But at this point, how's that going to help anyone?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's do this. And I think I was a stage manager for a long time, too, mm-hmm. and one of the big lessons that I've taken over time is when and how to release information to people within a show.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a delicate balance of ego and putting yourself out there, mm-hmm. like you say. Like, it's like, I want to feel good about myself. I also am nervous about doing this thing. I'm also nervous about performing something one of my friends wrote, you know, all the sorts of different stuff about that. And so I feel like it's my job to sort of keep them going, to buoy them and be like, hey, you did a great job. Everything went really well. You know, some nights are awesome. Like the last show we had was the Fallout fundraiser show. That was a hot crowd.
Yeah.
It was a hot, hot crowd. They were laughing before we said words. Like they were ready. They were into it.
Yeah.
They're into it. And so, you know, the three sketches that we put up, you know, if we had put them in a regular show, maybe they would have gotten the laughs. Maybe they wouldn't have. But this one, it was just like guffaws all around. Yeah. It made us feel great. Got us ready to prep the next show. But it was like, I didn't say anything to them. I was like, this is a great show and it went really well. But I know that this is a tipped crowd.
Yes.
This crowd is they're
preloaded. They know what they're there for, and they're there to deliver you laughs. Like,
exactly.
Like, they know that is their job.
This specific show was that purpose. Yeah. It was like, we're here to make you feel good about doing this, and then you're going to spend a month begging us for money. Like, that's what's going to happen. You know what I mean? But at the same time, like, I don't know. It's so fascinating. Like, I am recently bought, and of course hasn't read yet, but books about like audience reaction and like the way to communicate with an audience and like different ways to do it, because I'm really fascinated by the experience of it.
Me too. I'm very into that, and I'm very into like, how do you prime your audience?
Yeah.
Like, how do you, so Physics Curse, we have a format that we do that I'm like in love with. We don't do it all the time, but it's called Witching Hour. And the promise we make to the audience at the top is that we're going to tell them some sort of spooky story, and it's a narrative. But the thing that we do at the very beginning, and now if people who are listening, this is the key to the show, and so I'm spoiler alert, but is...
If they make it this far into the podcast, they get it.
Yay!
That's their win.
They win it. You're in on our secret. But our secret is at the very beginning, how we get our suggestion is... We ask the audience to turn to each other and to tell a true story of a time that of something spooky happening to them, whether it's they saw a ghost or they just felt creeped out. They tell that story, and then what we do is we come into the audience and we listen to their stories, and there's like creepy music playing, and then we come back up on stage and each of us kind of does a really quick recap of what we heard, of like one thing that we heard, and that's how we incorporate it into the show. The shows typically don't have very much spooky things, but we do the littlest thing and the audience thinks it's spooky because they went into their own minds and memories and are like, oh yeah, that did really creep me out. I've forgotten about that thing. So their body is already like there and primed and has tension.
Yeah.
And so then we get on stage and we start improvising. And the thing about tension, which I just love, and this is why I love this format, is tension is in comedy as is it in like scary stories, because when you think about a joke, you set the premise, you're building tension, and then you release the tension with the punchline.
Yeah.
And that's what you do in a scary story, is that I'm going to tell you that the stairs are creaking, which is the premise, and then eventually you're going to find out why, which is the punchline.
Yeah.
And so so that's what happens in the show. And every show that we've done, there's like we don't have to try very hard at all for it to be scary or spooky, because the audience almost establishes it for us.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, the interesting thing about that, too, is that you make them interact with each other.
Yeah.
That, I think,
has...
It unifies them mm-hmm. immediately. As soon as you make them do that, they've all done something mm-hmm. equally. It's like when we were talking about Improv 101. Like, when I teach classes, it's the first time I make them all do the same thing and they see no one's dead at the end.
Yeah.
Same with this. They've spoken to a stranger. They turned to a stranger yeah. and said things.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. Look, you talk to them.
You talk to them. It's fine.
It's totally all right.
Yeah. And they're going to hear things they've never heard. And, yeah, it's just fascinating to me. But that show, for me, really taught, like, oh, we can tell them how to feel. Like, we can, like, set it up that... Because, you know, most of the time they're like, oh, I'm here to laugh. And it's like, true, but in some shows you can feel other things, but we got to, like, set it up for you, because otherwise you're like, oh, I don't know how to feel. I guess I'm just going to sit here and have no reaction. When yeah. it's like, oh, no, you can feel, you know, sadness or happiness or whatever, or laugh whatever you want. Like, if you think that's funny, laugh. Who cares? We want you to laugh.
It is weird how people are afraid in the audience. Yeah,
they don't want the judgment.
Yeah, yeah. They don't want to laugh out loud.
Yeah.
Like it... In a slow build show, you'll hear the brave ones that'll laugh. Usually internal, let's be honest. Yeah. You get your two friends and the tech guy who know where the laughs should be.
Yeah.
So they give it a whole and hopefully somebody catches up on that sort of situation. Oh, I've done it myself.
Yeah.
Because I'll try not to act in the neighborhood I can lead laughter and claps on my back.
I'm 100% this person. So I used to feel, before I ever did improv, when I was a normie, that's what I refer to non-improvisers. Or people who just watch TV, I guess. I don't know what other people do who don't perform or make art or whatever. I just assume you must watch so much television.
I watch a lot of television.
I do too. So I watch a lot of television. Yeah. So I can't imagine the average life. But I used to be really embarrassed. I have a really loud laugh, very loud. Mm-hmm. It's kind of booming. And it like catches me off guard sometimes when I get really tickled, that it like kind of almost scare me because it's so loud. And, but what I love about it now, especially when I go see friends shows, is they will always tell me, like, I could hear you in the audience, and it was so reassuring, and, like, I'll be in a show, especially sketch, I feel like, where sometimes we're like, people, I think, have a critical eye, and they're gonna be like, I'm too smart for this, or I know where it's going, and I'm the person to be like, no, you don't know, and start laughing, and be like, you can laugh at this, he's been spending way too long trying to get that bread out of that bread bag. That's funny. This is going to get heightened in some way. We don't know how yet, but it'll be funny.
Yeah.
And so...
It's a little hard to separate yourself from the, like, hard rules of comedy, though. Yeah. Certain things that, like, after doing it for a while, you see with such rhythmic, like... Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I have a real hard time, speaking of television, I have a hard time watching comedy television.
Yeah.
It's got to be real confusing or very fast mm-hmm. for me not to just know what's happening immediately.
Yeah.
Like, and it's super hard. Like, basic sitcoms, it's just too simple for me.
Yeah, I agree.
I can't handle it. Like, and I'll count.
Yeah.
Like, I'll do three beats. I'll go, two. And my husband's like, what are we doing? I was like, sorry, they're on the second beat of the joke. And three. Here we go.
And then there's the callback from the beginning.
Yeah.
Remember when they made that joke 10 minutes ago?
Yeah.
We just had the callback for it.
a person in a writing staff just on for callback.
Yeah, exactly. I do feel similarly, although I have... So I need it to either be really, really bad, or I need it to be, like, absurdly good. Like, it's, like, the middle that I can't do. For example, lately I've been watching Glee, and Glee is such... a bad show. Like, I enjoy it because of the songs, but it's so, like, any time that they're actually trying to be comedic, most of the time I feel like they're trying to be, like, a soap opera. It's very dramatic. It's very hard stuff. But when they're trying to be really funny, it's so bad. And it's so... But I love it because it's so bad. I don't know, because it's so campy. And, man, that teacher just, like, wants to fuck those kids so bad. Oh, my God. That's the thing I always think where I'm like, how? I mean, he just wants to be one of the high school students and be in Glee Club, like, so bad. And he doesn't, and I say he wants to fuck them, but it's not in the, like, I'm, like, a pervy old man. It's more like, I want to fuck you because I wish I was 17 again.
Sure, sure.
Sure, that's better.
Yeah, I was like, that's a tough one. I don't think I'm watching Glee now. Yeah.
No, it's really bad. Don't watch it. It's so bad.
Yeah, I was like, no, I don't watch shows where people take advantage of it. No, I do watch lots of those, lots of crime shows.
But, oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, as far as comedy, it's going to be very...
What do you like? What's something you really like right now?
Oh, well, like, I used to love, or I loved How I Met Your Mother.
Okay.
Because it was three or four stories in one being told fast on top of each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I appreciated that because it was so fast that I was distracted from the three beats, from the pathway of the scene, from the, like, joke structure, which is there. Now that I've watched them multiple times, I can pick up on it. And I can pull it apart.
Yeah.
And it's a little easier for me to do. But at first, when I first saw those things, they would be, there is one overarching story of the whole show. Then there's per episode. Mm-hmm. And then within each one, everybody's got a little something. So you're then, they do a bunch of, like, I want to say tap outs, but that's not what.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like cut back, like
What are they called?
Hard cuts,
cutaways.
Cutaways.
Yeah, like in Family Guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Family Guy, I don't watch, but only just because they went so far that I was like, oh no, I'm so sorry.
I can't follow you on this journey.
I'm too. It's too dark for me. It's too dark for me. I was like, no, no, no. But I do like the format.
Yeah.
You know, because I like the cutaways and that kind of stuff. And they like go visit something silly for a while and then come back to it and that kind of stuff. And I enjoy that kind of stuff. As far as most of the other comedy stuff I watch in sort of solidarity to people who are doing comedy.
Yeah, so it's like, I get what you mean.
So it's like I watched Crashing with Pete Holmes because I like him.
Yeah, yeah. I get that.
And I'm going to knock on wood right now that it... that, you know, all of a sudden it doesn't turn out that he's a dickbag or whatever.
Yeah. I know.
Every day
funny?
There's a new one and I'm like, oh, please stop. Stop, 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 stop. But his show, I don't love it.
Yeah.
It's not wonderful. I think it would be more wonderful if I were younger and I was starting the journey the way his character is.
Mm.
Because something that's happening to me now is as I'm getting older and I'm at different points in my life, I identify with different characters.
Yeah.
So, like, there are different kinds of, like, for instance, I was watching Friends when you walked
in. Yeah.
No surprise, audience. my, like, the people who I've identified with change as it goes through. You know what I mean?
I'm so curious who you identify with.
Well, initially, of course, Chandler. He's the basic for all comedy people.
Yeah.
That's how it is. We use it as a... crutch, and we're all a little sad. That's Chadwick. That's Chandler.
Yeah.
Right? And that's great, but as it moves through, you start seeing different things. Now, one thing I realize also from writing comedy, and when I teach writing comedy, I always say this, comedy characters are not good people.
Yeah.
They're not. They're never going to be.
Yeah.
Why? Because we have to keep watching them fail to laugh at them.
Yeah, yeah.
If they were good at life, it would be a boring show.
Yeah.
So I have tough times with each one of them because they're shitty humans, but I ebbs and flows. So, like, you know, there have been times maybe in the past couple of years where I've super identified with Phoebe and her freedom of life. Mm-hmm. Like, she's been all sorts of things, and she thinks it's ridiculous that you have rules.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like we were talking about, you know.
Yeah, it's rules of society.
It's crazy. What
Phoebe's
are you
against
about?
Them. Yeah.
Hey, you're wild. That's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's other little things. Like, recently I've been, you know, kind of feeling a little Monica.
I gotta tell you, I'm a Monica girl.
Yeah.
It's never really changed for me. I feel like out of the whole show, I always identify with Monica.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I'm very clean.
Sure.
I like to think I'm not high strung, but I think all high strung people do that.
My dad used to say, because our whole family is high strung.
Yeah.
He'd go, where easy go.
My dad always put it, he always used to say, you're either a person who puts away your shopping cart or you're not.
I feel, oh my God.
that hit a truth.
Oh God, so much. Every time I return the cart, I say out loud, loudly for people to hear me, because I'm not a horrible person.
I'm not a monster. Yeah. Why wouldn't you return the cart? It has a home. You're making this a homeless cart.
There's so many places to put it. They're so close.
It's going to get abducted, and then suddenly it doesn't have a home anymore, and that's how they get abandoned underneath highways. Like, put your carts away.
Not to mention that it's like, you make it difficult. A parking lot is a dangerous place yes. in and of itself.
Yes.
It is a no-fault zone. It is a place where there's so many blind spots and people and things.
Yeah.
You can't also have these metal carts to knock into my car and break my lights and shit.
Yes.
Like,
yes. No. I completely agree.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So I'm the kind of person, like your dad, who legitimately, that's the wheat from the chaff for me.
Yeah.
If we were Noah's Arking the world, I'd be like, those of you that put it away, those of you who did not can get on the ark with me. Like it would just be, and I think it would be probably horrible.
Yeah.
Terrible with all those people. You need a few of the wild cards. Yeah. But
You need a few of them. But
I feel the exact same way so vehemently.
I know. It really did hit a chord. But I like grew up.
I say it so often. It's just amazing.
Because it's like, because I think if you do it, you know you're better than everybody else.
Yes.
Yes. You're just like, dude. Because I understand where my place in society is and how I can help be a part of this community.
If we all just did our jobs,
yes,
everything would be better.
Yeah.
Everyone, everything. If the trash collector who picked up the trash on my street made sure that there wasn't excess on the street that blows into my yard, it would be better.
Yeah.
If the person who works as the barista, like, put the Splenda in and not some sort of almond milk situation, which I don't know where they got that idea. You know, all sorts of things. Where it's like, everyone, every level of every job. And I'm sure, and I know some jobs are way harder than other jobs. And sometimes I try to be patient about how long it takes a thing to accomplish.
Yeah.
Or, like, especially if I've had a job. Like, I've worked in call centers.
Yeah.
Customer service for any companies.
You know? Yeah.
So when a person has to put me on hold because they have to check with A, B, or C before they can do whatever, I'm like, go ahead.
Yeah, you do.
Have a nice time.
Yeah.
You're doing the work that I asked you to do. Go do it. I'll wait. And I'm not going to complain about the time that I'm waiting because I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right?
You're doing your job.
Yeah. That's all I want. That's all I want. And I even appreciate when people, like, in that same situation, mm-hmm. when they say things to me that I can't do. I ask him for something. Like, no, ma'am, I'm real sorry. We can't do that. I go, okay.
That's okay.
But they're doing their job. They're doing it. They've accomplished their job.
I think you're a Monica. I got to tell you, this all feels very Monica to me.
Yeah, and my new mom persona is very Monica. I clean up this house. I mean, I know that you're like, you cleaned up this house, but house is covered in toys on a regular basis, and every minute I'm like putting them away.
Yeah.
I secretly tell myself that I'm teaching him how to clean up, but really I'm not. I'm just putting things away.
So I'm a very neat person. I wouldn't say like I'm a clean freak because it can be, like, I don't dust all the time and like sweep constantly. It's not that, but it's like, I like things to be in order.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will do this thing, even if I'm running late, I will take a moment and like what I call resetting my apartment, and that it's like, all the pillows are nice. All the, like, if I had dishes out, they're in the sink. Like, just so when I come in, it's like, we have a baseline of order.
Yeah.
And so then that way it always feels calm, because I like my house to feel very calm and it to be like a retreat. I don't want it to be a stressful place. And, But when I have friends over and we're, like, leaving, I feel like I get looks like, did you have to fluff that pillow? I'm like, I have to. I have to reset. This is an important part of my self-care.
No, it's important. Yeah. I mean, you gotta, I feel that way as well. Like, there are certain ways that I have to set things up.
Yeah.
And now with the baby, there's a lot more things I have to organize. Like, when he goes to bed, because he is a wonderful child who goes to bed at 6:30 p.m., and leaves me for the rest of the evening to do whatever I need to do. So I cover the table with things. But when he's out here, I can't have these things on this table.
Yeah, yeah.
He would knock down and rip everything, pour all my water out, break the computer. Like, yeah. Just because he's
a little kaiju, tiny, basically.
Yeah, he just, he's tiny and strong, and he just crushes things with his little fists, you know, like, but it's like, I'm cool with it, you know? Yeah. I tried to be okay with that kind of stuff, and I think I'm leaning right into it.
Now going back to what you said about your dad, what was the mantra they all say that y'all are
easy going?
Because as you were saying this, you're like telling your aunt, I just do these things, yeah. No big deal, yeah. And I'm so easy going.
It's like I'm an insane person, but I think I'm easy going.
I'm a really direct person, like with friends, and it has a lot to do with just I think how I was brought up, and that the posy side of my family, which is my dad's side, they're all really into debate. We'd have like really heated discussions, but it was always from a place of respect. People never, every once in a while, like breaks down into like getting personal, but for the most part. And they like really encouraged it. And so, but a big part of that was like, when it was too much, you had to speak up. You had to say like, I'm getting too emotional and I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And then it'd be like, oh, well then we don't want to do this anymore. Let's move on. Like it's more important that you're okay than us having this discussion. And so I feel like that's what I was taught.
That's great.
Yeah. Which is awesome. And so I feel like it's given me a lot of really great skills to speak up when I feel uncomfortable. And like, it's like, I think about when it comes to interactions with society and like men and all of that and dating and those kinds of things, I've never really had issues to be like, nope, I'm uncomfortable, you're making me uncomfortable, leave. Like,
yeah. I also don't have that issue.
Yeah, I've never had it, and I'm very like, and I think I take up a lot of space too. I've never been one that's like, oh, I don't know, do I need permission? I don't feel like I need permission. I'm just a human being just like you, and I can take that up as much space as I want, and doesn't make me an asshole. It just makes me someone who wants to take up space, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But what's funny is because I'm really direct, I tend to be very communicative about what I need and what I want, but I want to be like low maintenance and easy peasy. So I'll be like, so I feel like a lot of my romantic interactions always start out like this, where I'm like, hey, what's your deal? I'm really into you. I think you're really hot and I like want to date you or want to have sex with you. But is that okay with you? You know, whatever. It's ever cool with you. It's fine. You know?
Yeah.
But I'm into you and I want to make this happen right now. Like, it's like this level.
You know what, though? That's not crazy.
It's not crazy.
And I mean, especially as we move forward into, like, societal changes with dating, that would be a wonderful interaction. Yeah.
Well, and
a person being honest about how they feel and then being like, but I am fully accepting if what your feelings are do not reflect or connect with what I'm saying. Like,
I feel like I have interactions with like a person, people I've dated before, where we've been like sexting, like we've been like getting really hot and heavy. But then me being like, I'm the one who initiated this, and I'm the one who's kind of being hot and heavy. So let me just take a step back and be like, hey, and just FYI, if you want this to stop at any point, you just let me know. My feelings won't be hurt. I just want to make sure you're 100% into this. And they're like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm like, okay, great. Now tell me about your date. You know, like,
well, 90% of dudes are generally into that kind of stuff.
And women too. And so because I'm bi, and so, and so my
female. Well, I've dated women too. I was just thinking about that today, about how different it is. And
it is.
About how even safer, just, even safer, just a lot of I haven't dated in years.
Yeah.
And so all of my dating was, let's say, pre-Me Too.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of, you know, like, some people are into stuff and some people aren't.
Right.
Doesn't matter what their gender is. It's just different. And I was thinking today about, you know, one of those, you ever have, like, somebody from your past who, like, you're not going to, like, leave town and go love them. But if you saw them, you'd be like,
I know those. Yeah.
I got one of those, and it's this gal who was in a band, when I was in New York City, and I mean, she lay waste to every person in the community.
Yeah.
Everybody. She'd walk by and it was just like,
and the little hearts are like trailing her.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a music video every time, you know? And it's just, you think about those kinds of things, but she was really guarded.
Yeah.
And very protective. And like, if you tried, so because everyone was super in love with her. Everybody tried to date her.
Yeah.
And she was very like, no, no, yeah. no, yeah. no, no.
Yeah.
And I think it was because, and sort of brings it around to some of the fame stuff we were talking about before, is that we were all enchanted by her talent.
Yeah.
She went up on stage with that guitar and she became a troubadour of the highest order.
Mm-hmm.
Everything she sang was the most beautiful thing in the whole wide world, but there's a power to that. The audience into that, they immediately are like, oh, everything you do is so wonderful. So she was like, no, I can't.
Yeah.
This is not. Because she was like, you don't see me for me.
Yeah.
You're not seeing me. You are seeing this person that I'm putting out in front of you. You're not seeing me. And I feel like that happens a lot, like, with people who are in film
mm-hmm.
and TV. You meet them. Think of, reference again to How I Met Your Mother. Think of the guy who played Ted.
Yeah.
He played Ted for 10 years, okay?
Oh, my God.
He could do 1,000 things.
Yeah.
I've seen him in multiple movies since then because I love the show so much. I was like, I'll support him. But he's so different.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
And I've listened to podcasts with him, and he's like, yeah, I'm nothing like Ted.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just
a character.
But
yeah.
it's like, it's so formed in my mind because that's what I'm seeing in
that's
that
thing.
That's
what you're consuming.
And I don't know, it's interesting to see, I think it's important to bring it back to where we started this, to be open and honest about how you personally feel and direct.
Yeah.
Because then everyone can be who they want and giving them the ability to stop it. Maybe they are, who knows, they could be in a business meeting.
Yeah.
They could be talking to their mom.
And they could be conflicted,
like,
right? I think that's the thing I always worry about, especially because I think because I'm, who knows where I got this confidence, but I'm very confident in myself and very, like, assured of myself and my feelings. Like, I'm never someone who's wishy-washy of, like, do I want this? I'm not sure. I'm usually like, nope, or yes. But I know that not everyone is that way. Like, my sister is definitely not that way, and I'm grateful for that because I realize how I can influence her to make a decision, and then I'm like, oh, did you make that decision for yourself, or did you do it for me? And I don't want that from a partner. I want, if we're having an interaction, I would feel awful if you went along with it because you felt like you would disappoint me or there would be some sort of retaliation. Like, I want you to be in it because you want to be in it.
Yeah.
That's what excites me. And so, I want you to be all about me. And so, I don't know, like, having those, it's almost reassuring for me to have that, like, pump the brakes for a second and be like, cool, are you into this?
Yeah.
If you're not, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay you're not. But you have, you can make a choice right now, and it's 100% fine. Also, you can make a choice 2 hours from now, and that's fine too. But also, check in with yourself. Are you doing this because you are enjoying it or because you feel like you have to?
Yeah.
Especially because I think I'm very attracted to people who tend to be, like, shyer and more introverted, and I don't know why, you know, you're attracted to a thing, and so I'm always worried that they feel the power of my own will and are just going along with it.
You know what, though? I was just thinking when you said introvert, I've done that as well.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's just a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
You fit into the spot that they don't have filled in.
Yeah.
Like, and so while there might be some people that you date who aren't ready for that sort of, like, you know, yin and yang, some people really are.
Yeah.
And part of me feels like you should try your debate thing. And that's a first date thing.
Yeah, yeah,
if they
exactly.
can make it through a debate, then they get a second date.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It's so true,
because
though.
Because it's really hard,
especially
these days, to express any level of opinion that is not whatever is popular opinion.
Yeah, it amazes me. It amazes me that we can't have just, like, civil discourse of going back and forth about something and people... Well, and, like... And because I feel, like I said, I'm not wishy-washy. I have a very strong opinion about whatever it is. Or I have no opinion at all. I'm one of those people where I'm like, I don't care about this. It's like, people always ask me about food. It's like, what would be your last meal on Earth? I'm like, I don't give a fuck. I'm dying. Like, I don't care.
Or you're in jail. Come on, I mean, I guess you're going to die.
Some way.
In that moment.
But... I'm just like, I don't know, can I have a cigarette? I would rather have that than eating.
Yeah. I quit smoking so long ago, but I still think about it all the time.
Oh, my God, because it's just the best.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely great.
So,
but I hear you about, like, I have a hard time because I went to a college that was, like, your...
Family,
where it was, like, very into discussions.
Yeah.
And even though Some people found my... I went to a Catholic college, so okay. Some people found it stifling.
Yeah.
I never was, because I'm like you, where it was like, I've never let... I'm confident.
Yeah.
I've never let a person who disagreed with me... I'm not... I don't take it personally.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
You know, because if we... We have the ability to have lots of different perspectives and points of view. Why aren't we taking advantage of them?
Yeah.
And I feel like we are... Oh, I've gone down a different road, but I'm going to go with it.
Yeah, do it.
I feel like we were trying really hard for diversity. Diversity in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with diversity that people don't respect or deal with well is that the purpose, the beauty, the reason why diversity is important is because you need to get a bunch of people in a room that all have different points of view.
100%.
That disagree.
Yes.
You don't want to get 10 people in a room that agree.
Yeah.
No. You need them to disagree. Why? Yeah. Because their point of view is important.
Yeah.
And you need to figure out for whatever story you're telling or yep. whatever thing that you're building or product that you're making, what way does every different possible point of view react to this?
Yep.
Right? And in certain groups, so like to take it back smaller mm-hmm. to us being in a small town theater like world.
Yeah.
I'm focused on my audience. Mm-hmm. The audience that I'm expecting to have at most of my sketch shows are 20-something liberals.
Yeah.
That's who I get.
Yeah.
That's who I write sketches for.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if something conservative happened in the world that I think is really important for us to talk about or deal with, it's not going to hit. So there's no way.
Yep.
And for me, it's become really difficult. So the diversity, which is this beautiful, wonderful thing, but that requires a lot of work.
Yeah.
People don't want that. They want to live in their bubbles of yep. a bunch of people that agree with them and tell them that everything that they're saying is right. And the problem is everyone's in that bubble.
Yeah.
So the people that disagree are never, and it gets further and further, I feel, from those people being able to even have a discussion
yeah.
to accomplish a goal.
Well, like, they polarize themselves, right? Where it's yeah. like, well, you think this, well, then I can't believe anything you say.
Right.
You know, and it's, which is, doesn't do any of us any good, right? It's just we all disregard it. It's so hard because, I mean, especially in our times, right, where we have horrific things happening and depending on where, from what perspective, I think on both sides, people think horrific things are happening.
Yeah.
And my parents are very conservative and I'm very pretty liberal. Although because I grew up in a conservative town and the people I grew up with, they were smart people. They were business owners and now some of them are very deeply racist. But even then, these people, like, it's crazy to me. I think about from the time I was like 10 to now and how much my hometown has changed. And it's like, I can see how things are changing, taking a long time, but it is happening.
Mm-hmm.
But these people live in this country too, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so it's like, we can disregard what they think based on what your own values are, or we can, but we say this, but it's like, we're not taught, what language do you use? How do you have these discussions in a way that you can both walk away and still have respect and like, are emotionally okay? And that's really hard. And I don't have an answer. And I don't think I necessarily do it any better than like the next person. But
I think the way to yeah. communicate is going to change every day for yeah. the next 5-10 years.
Yeah.
Until we have a truly new way to communicate and we won't even notice.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm noticing changes as they're happening now.
Yeah.
But once the full change is complete, we won't know.
Yeah. Because it'll be so discernible. Yeah, it'll be a part of it.
And it'll be one way or the other, I think. I actually think it's either we're going to go full polarization.
Yeah.
And I have this theory that I've said multiple times that I think the United States is going to break up into multiple parts.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think this big country is going to stick as one big country. I think it's going to break into
mm-hmm.
parts that these people think this, these people think that, whatever. And that's just how it's going to go. And
yeah.
we'll deal with it in a smaller way, which is probably better because the fewer people in a room, the easier it is to get to a consensus or like a what's really good for the overall kind mm-hmm. of thing. But that's if we polarize. If we push everyone away that doesn't agree with us, then we will divide ourselves into
yeah.
sanctions, and it'll be the people who believe this up north, and the people that believe this yep. in the middle of the area, and then, you know, in California they believe this, whatever. in the three states of California. But, like, as far as what we have experienced, being able to have these conversations, to debate stuff, I think it is super important.
Yeah.
Since I was a... your family had conversations around a table and just chatted about stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't... So I think family dinner was, like, a huge thing growing up for me until I got into, like, high school. And then my parents were very busy and I was busy as well. But, yeah, it was mostly that. But then with the Posey family, it had a lot to do with holidays. Mm-hmm. We'd all get together and we didn't watch TV or anything. We'd all just kind of sit around and play cards and games. Yeah, and just talk about stuff. Mm-hmm. And I guess my mom's side of the family was the same way, but the difference was is they were all on the same page. They were all kind of the same political thinking, mm-hmm. and had similar backgrounds. Whereas my dad's side of the family, he's one of five kids and then kind of like one semi-adopted kid. And they all have very different political beliefs. Like, some of them are liberal-leaning, and then some are very conservative. But then as far as, like, walks of life, we have an actor, we have someone who's a teacher of the deaf, we have someone who sells insurance, we have a preacher, and we have a veterinarian. Yeah. Like, their career experience is also different. Some of them chose to not have children. Some of them have multiple children. Some have adopted children. So, like... Yeah. And their interactions with government are just different, mm-hmm. Because, you know, when adoption, you have like these different organizations that have oversight into your adoption and all this kind of thing. And so I think that's the thing I saw so much was these people who all dearly love each other and are very stubborn and very confident in their own points of view, but they love each other. And so they're going to talk about these hard things. Well, it's like, I remember gay marriage, them talking about it in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I remember when Ellen DeGeneres, I vividly remember Ellen DeGeneres coming out and my parents wanting to boycott ABC at the time because they were like, we don't believe in gay marriage. And us going to Thanksgiving and my Uncle Matt being like, are you kidding me? Like, why would you take this away from her? Like, why would you think that gay... Why? Like, you say you love people and God, that's the most important thing from God and like... Why would you do that? And them having this really big discussion and kind of my parents walking away being like, well, he doesn't get it. He's not truly Christian, that kind of thing. But now, you know, fast forward 20 years and my parents are adamantly for gay marriage and the rights of LGBTQA and all of that. And
hell, so's the Pope.
I mean, yes, exactly. I mean, and it's just like,
I don't think anybody thought that was going to happen.
And when I was talking with my dad about it, recently, because I recently came out to my parents as being bi, and which that was like a whole thing, especially going kind of so late in my life, but it was really important to me that I had this conversation with them. I don't know, and I'm talking to them, and my dad was just like, he said, I'm so grateful that y'all kept talking to me about these things. He said, I can remember when Matt, my brother, was talking to me about it, and Candy, my sister, was talking to me about it. He's like, but then I can remember when my sister Abra was in high school. She had a really close friend who was a lesbian. And, you know, y'all kept bringing examples and talking to me about it. But you didn't talk down to me. You didn't make me feel like an idiot. You didn't shame me. But you're just like, you don't understand this. Or you're claiming that you don't understand it and that you think it's wrong. And you can believe that and I love you still. But I'm going to keep talking to you about it.
Yeah.
And then it's just over time, he saw, like, wow, yeah, this is just a thing I accepted and believed because people had told it to me. And now experiencing, like, why would I oppress this group of people? Why would I tell them they can't do it? They love each other. Why would I get in the way of that?
Yeah.
Especially, it doesn't hurt my experience in love and marriage.
It really does not.
Yeah.
What anybody else what does.
It doesn't.
I mean, you know, individually.
Yeah.
Sure, large groups, they can affect change. But it's like this individual human being wants to, you know... have love in her tennis shoes, let her fucking do
it.
Also, she's the best. hilariously, Ellen was one of my dad's faves.
Oh, that's
funny. He watched her show daily.
Oh.
And he'd send me messages about her.
That's so funny. I have written I was going back, my parents moved from College Station to Amarillo 2 years ago, or last year, I guess. And I, no, 2 years ago. And I got all these journals from growing up and other childhood memorabilia, and I was looking through a journal from late high school, and I had written, how I know I will have made it as an actress is if I am on the Ellen DeGeneres Show being interviewed about the play and or musical I have written.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'd love to just meet Ellen DeGeneres.
Me too.
I bet you she would be stiff, not because she's not lovely, but because she puts so much of herself out there every single day that she's gotta hold back a little
bit. Oh, I'm sure. It's funny, I was just having this conversation, I think it was with Ann Simmons, like, who would you want to meet if you could meet any, like, comedian and or performer or whoever? And I realized so many of mine now, it's because, like, I listen to her podcast or I've seen an interview and they just feel so warm and I could feel like we could be friends. It's not like, so Carrie Brownstein's one. I read her book, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. Have you read that or have you heard of it? It's about her time being in, so Carrie Brownstein's was in Portlandia, Fred Armisen's duo, and then, but she was also in Sleater-Kinney and was a bassist, and, yeah, and so.
It's funny because when Portlandia came out, I was like, this woman seems so familiar to me, but I don't think I've ever seen her in comedy. What is, what's the situation? That's fascinating.
And then she was a reporter and was a writer for, like, Rolling Stone, and she did that for a long time and then got into comedy. Basically her and Fred basically met and then like just hit it off and started creating stuff together. It's crazy. Sure.
Well, he's a musician too.
Exactly. So. And that's how they met.
Stone, yeah.
Yeah. And, after reading her book, she deals with depression and I also too, as most people in comedy, it feels like, but how she talks about it, I was like, oh my God, I just like want to get in a room and hang out with this woman and talk about this and how you deal with it. And, but the book itself is about her time in Sleater-Kinney and, like, the grunge scene in Seattle. And it's really good. It's really interesting. But, like, her, I'm really obsessed with Emily Heller. She's a stand-up comedian. Uh-huh. Yeah, and she writes on Barry now, which is insane to me.
what a bunch of.
Yeah, she, but I've been listening. She has a podcast called Baby Geniuses, and I've been listening to it for, like, 7 years. And whenever I started listening to it, how I even found it was she wrote an article for Fast Company about how debate makes you a good comedian.
Oh.
And then I looked her up and found her podcast. And she also does it with a illustrator and designer named Lisa Hannawalt, who is the creative director for BoJack Horseman now.
Oh.
But when they started this podcast, they both lived in New York and were just kind of doing their own thing, trying to, you know, make it in this business. And now they both live in L.A. and write for shows, which they highly contribute to and, you know, work on. It's crazy.
Yeah, whenever I see people that I've known, like, in person.
Yeah.
Or, you know, knew them before they were famous. Yeah. And I see them get something, I'm all like, look at you. Oh, my God.
But, yeah, I've been listening to this podcast for, like, 7 years. And so I feel like I know her so well. And I just love her stand-up. I've seen her do it stand-up once in San Francisco. And so, yeah, I just, like, have this little dream of us getting cocktails together.
Yeah. Well, those are some pretty great ladies to be, you know, interested in meeting, especially like, you know, it's not like you're like Angelina Jolie or somebody who's like uber famous or something. It's like these are people that are like working, they're doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I like with Carrie Brownstein, she had like multiple adventures.
Yes.
She didn't just do one thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the idea of success in her brain is different than other people's because, you know, we're talking about a single track, whereas she did all the tracks.
Yeah.
She was like, I'm going to be in a band. Oh, I'm going to be a writer now. Yeah. Oh, now I'm going to be a comedian in a hit show. Like,
I think that's what I'm fascinated by. I think I'm fascinated by people who go on lots of different journeys. And I love seeing the behind the scenes of the work that went into it because it feels, because I can relate to that. It feels more achievable to me versus like, oh, you did this one thing, you hit it big, and then you had all these opportunities. Like, that's cool. That's a cool story. But for me, I'm so much more interested in hearing, like, it's like on Baby Geniuses, Emily talks about like the place, like, she was single for a long time, and now she has a boyfriend. They've been living together, and they, like, bought a house together. And just talking about all these things, and then she talks about the book she reads and how that inspires this one set. Now she's trying to name her album that she just recorded. And it's all this stuff that I'm like, yeah, it's so hard to decide what your cover album is, or the cover art for your album is going to be.
Yeah.
And, like, what the name is. And, like, in this last podcast I listened to, she was talking about how she really has to work against the impulse to hold on to a joke that no one likes because she loves it.
Oh, yeah, that's so hard.
She's like, I know it's a bad habit and I just need to let it go, but I love it. And who am I doing this for? Me. But you know, when you write on a show, you can't do that. And so she was talking about naming her comedy album after a joke that doesn't land in the set, just to like have that little relic of like, I don't care.
Yeah. I find that some people will name their albums after the one weird thing.
Yeah.
Like the thing where when you read the title, you're like, what the fuck is this? And then it comes in as like a side thought about two-thirds of the way through, and you're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Great. Awesome. Whatever. I don't know. That's pretty wild, though. I feel like that idea of holding on to a joke connects deeply to the sketch comedy conversation we had, too, about how it's like, you know, sometimes you want to just do this joke even though nobody's going to laugh at it.
Yeah, because for whatever reason, it, like, speaks to you, right? Because I think that's kind of what comedy is. Well, and I think creating art generally, but comedy as well, is, like, digging into the thing that makes you who you are versus someone else. And, like, once you can kind of tap into that, that to me is, like, where you get the wall of inspiration and where you can find the unique thing versus, like, riffing off the same idea that everybody else has had.
Yeah.
But that's so hard, I feel like, to get to that because it's very vulnerable. And also, it might not be good. It might not be funny. Mm-hmm. But that's my favorite, I think, type of comedy is when people are digging into the unique, weird things that make them who they are. Yeah, I don't know.
I have a hard time with that because, personally, I think of myself as a very, like, easygoing. No. as a very generic, basic. I know I'm not basic by standards of what quote-unquote basic is. But I mean, like, whenever I'm, like, people say, find the thing that's unique about you, I'm like,
I'm a
regular lady that's pretty normal. And it's funny, it's just because it's my perspective.
Yeah.
My perspective of myself is, this is a regular way to live. And then I have to rip myself out of my own perspective to see that. And I think that, sort of to bring it to the other debate stuff, is what both artists and everyone really needs to do. Like, you have to be able to see, or at least try to see through somebody else's eyes.
Yes, I agree.
That is not only in the political discussions, and I think some people are just out there trying to rise people up, you know, mess with people, get them going.
Yeah, they're shit stirrers. They like to stir the shit.
Yeah, they want to see what happens because you can witness it.
Yeah.
You can drop a dynamite bomb. And then the whole thing.
Oh my God. I have a friend who every once in a while likes to pretend that he's a flat earther. And so he'll go into flat earther Facebook groups and pretend to be among them and just be spouting bullshit. And they're all like, yeah. And then he'll have another friend who'll be like, try to argue with him. But they're friends. And so they're just doing a bit. And I'm like, y'all are crazy. These flat earth, stop it. How do you get joy out of this? But the shit stirs. That's why. Shit stirs. That's why.
I mean, I wish to a certain extent he was going in for, like, education purposes. To be like, hey, I'm happy. Because, like, I'm very much like, you believe whatever you want, but here's the thing. You got to defend it. I was saying, I didn't mention it earlier, but I like to keep my own personal ideas, to myself. Mm-hmm. Because over time, I, you know, there have been times in my life when people haven't liked things that I've said and it's caused, you know, trouble or I also imagined that I would be famous.
Yeah.
So I couldn't be telling you what I really think because who knows if the corporation that will own me can possibly accept that kind of thing. Right?
Yeah.
And of course I'm not famous, nor do I need to do that kind of thing. But based on the college that I went to and learning how to argue, I will always do the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
I will sit and quietly listen to a conversation, figure out what everybody believes, find the opposite end of that, and then go defend that.
Yeah.
Even if it's horrible and ridiculous and insane. Even if it's the worst, meanest possible thing.
Man.
I will go, okay, but what if...
But what if the earth is flat?
Have you personally taken a boat?
Yes.
Chris Columbus hit this land. He didn't fall off the edge, though, did he?
No.
I mean, I don't know where the edge would be.
Oh, because we're on the back of a turtle. You know, I mean, this is what flat earthers think. You know,
No, I don't.
Yes, it's like I can't think of what this is called. It's like it's curved, basically. It's curved, but not a globe, and it's on the back of a giant turtle. You should look this up. It'll excite you to get educated on the beliefs.
It's like when I watch the Scientology.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, this is terrible.
Yeah, why?
Have something to offer.
Yeah.
I get that some people have been made famous by this organization, but a small handful.
Yeah.
Let's be clear.
Yeah.
How much is it helping the rest of you?
Oh, man.
But, you know, it's ridiculous things like that where I'm always like, but if put in a position where I had to defend that side, I would do it.
Yeah.
Why? Just because.
Just because.
Just because I want to see the other side of it.
Yeah.
And because I like to allow my brain to really expand.
Yeah.
To the idea of why people would do it. Because some people get so mad about, like, you know, stuff the government does. And I go, you know, the government's a humongous thing.
Yeah.
And also, they're not really concerned about individuals.
Yeah.
There are millions, billions of us.
Yeah.
Just here. And they're trying to navigate it all. And yeah, not always positively. Not always with our best interests in mind. Maybe with our best interests 200 years in the future in mind or whatever.
Yeah.
But, so I try to like, pull. I'm like, you know, the reason why they had to do that was because of blank, blank, and blank.
Yeah.
Whatever
it
might be.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I'll admit this current administration is a bit of a PR nightmare. But I try to like, I try to wrap my mind around it.
Yeah.
I go, what does he think he's doing?
Yeah.
What's the team, what is their brain trying to think of?
Yeah.
Because the only thing that can like, and even if it's nefarious, even if it's like, oh, no, they just want money.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
A motivation, right? And I think that's the key is, I think it's really interesting how people will just dismiss and like, oh, they're crazy. Oh, they're dumb. And it's like, no, people.
It's like an improv scene.
Yeah, people are always motivated by something.
Yep.
And once you understand that, it'll become more clear their choices. And
a lot more often fear than other things.
It's one, oh my gosh. That's what it is. It's fear so often. One thing that made me think earlier when we were talking about sketch and talking about a joke that doesn't work or holding on to a joke, I will say the thing I do really, really love. Now, I don't love when it happens, but I appreciate when it happens. So I love a good bomb. Like, a good... there's no way to save the sinking ship. And I love the moment when everybody on stage knows it. And you're like, you look up at the clock, especially in improv, and you're like, we got 10 more minutes of this show. Like, they hate us. We're arguing or like not on the same page.
Yeah.
And it's like, we have to keep going. And I kind of revel in that feeling of like, there's no way to save this. And we can either be mad about it or we can just be like, oh, well, and keep going. And to me, those are the moments. I always feel like bad shows are the defining moments with the people I've collaborated with. It's not good shows. Good shows always bring people together and everybody's happy and blah, blah, blah. Bad shows are the definers of, can we continue collaborating or is this probably going to dissolve one day?
Dude, exactly what you've said. US of A.
Yeah, yes, like, yes.
That's the exact theory that I have.
Yeah.
Because it's a troop.
Yes.
Is it going to work? Are we still all on the same page?
Yeah.
Because, you know, 1776, we really were.
Yeah.
2018, are we?
Yeah, yeah.
Are we really?
Yeah.
Like, well, let's be honest, the last state was in like the 1950s.
Yeah.
So really,
yeah,
we've only been 50.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, as far, whenever you tell me that theory, that makes complete sense to me because I think it's very egotistical and short-sighted to assume that we would stay together forever because nothing stays together forever. Eventually, one of you dies.
And you know why Canada's such a big country
that
maintains? Is because 80% of the land is unused.
Yes, exactly. Like, they're all on the border,
right? They're all in the section.
Yeah.
Like, they're all in one area.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's like seven provinces or something. I'm sorry, Canada, I don't know much about you. But like, they're all in one area. Yeah. To the point where it's like the metropolitan situation is all handled over there, and they've got, you know, whereas we're everywhere.
Yeah.
We're all over the place. And it's so growing. Far away.
Yeah. And it's growing, right? And everybody's experiences are so different. But it just feels short-sighted. And I mean, it's kind of like having discussions of like us being a power country, like a supreme power and all of that, where I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's awesome that we are a world power, but are we always going to be? I mean, that kind of feels like egotistical to say that we are.
Bring it back to an improv troupe.
Yeah.
Imagine if now there's a number of improv troupes in this town who are like top improv troupes, the ones where everybody knows their name, all that stuff. But what if they started coming out and telling everybody they were king shit?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think? I'd be like, fuck you.
Fuck you.
They'd be like, we see you once a week and you're amazing, but now we hate you because of this bullshit.
But here's the thing, and they have to work at it, though. That's part of it, too, is that it's like, you can be there, you have your slot, but if you stop showing up, if you stop doing the good work, eventually you'll fall off that slot. People stop coming, and then the theater may or may not change it up, right? And
you keep having to work at it.
You have to.
Relationships, everything.
Yeah.
This, being an American is a relationship with other Americans.
Yes.
And being a person in a city, you have to relationship with other people in your city, other people in your improv troupe, other people in the room with
your cart away.
Put your cart away.
Put your card away.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Put your card away. I'm writing it down because I need to make sure everyone knows.
That's the name of the episode.
You got it.
Put your card away. An interview with Rachel Austin.
You got it. Oh, man. Well, I want to... we've had such a lovely chat. Oh, my God. We're almost to 2 hours.
Oh, my God. Are we really? Wow.
Yeah, it's totally okay.
Okay.
I was like, don't look at the time. Right. To wrap up, I wanted to ask you, we were talking about how... you've found ways to be confident and, you know, you express yourself in the world to a comedian, to a person who's trying to figure out what to do or how to be themselves or how to get the confidence to put themselves out there, to be vulnerable that you were talking about. Is there any bit of advice that you could give to somebody out there to keep them going?
Yeah. I think it's a couple things, and I don't think these are groundbreaking ideas, but one is surround yourself with people who support you and are actually supporting you in the sense of you being yourself and they are encouraging it and not tearing it down. Especially passive-aggressive comedy can happen where it's like people trying to out-funny each other.
Yeah.
Be around people where you can just be yourself and you don't have to be funny and invite them to your shows. And I think that is a key thing, is having that support. And then for me, I think the thing that I found and the thing I encourage people to do is to do the thing that is actually inspirational to you and is exciting. Don't just chase stage time. Chase the thing that's actually going to feed you and excite you, and dig in and find out why and keep chasing that thing. And I feel like there is a confidence that you will build because you will know what you enjoy. And then it becomes a lot easier to know, like, oh, I wasn't right for that because I wasn't that into it. Sometimes you have to take gigs or chase gigs because you do need the practice and you do need the stage time. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important as artists and performers to cultivate that inner world of what do I like and what inspires me and what excites me and who do I want to collaborate with. And being really thoughtful and direct about it versus it being this passive thing that 5 years from now you're like, well, I don't know why I did any of those shows or why I did those things. It's just like filling time. Like, I think that's can really eat at your own ego and your own self-perception because you don't even know what you're about. And then the last thing is just like, I think really reveling in yourself. I don't know. I think about... as far as like my own confidence, one of the things growing up, I think I had a lot of body image issues, and I think as a lot of women do. But one of the things I did when I was like 15, and I've always been bigger than everybody else. Like, I always had big shoulders. I've been this size since I was like in fifth grade. People always thought I was the teacher, and always because I dressed really nice. Because I was like someone who dressed up for school. But I was like 15. I know. When I was 15, I was listening to my mom like talk badly about her body and talking about she was fat and ugly and these things. And in that moment, I was like, oh, I don't want that. I hate this. I hate listening to this from her, and I don't want to be this person. And so I like made a decision. I was like, I'm not gonna talk about my body like that anymore. And it's weird how just doing that, I feel like I stopped tearing my body down. And now I feel like even as I've gotten older, I've loved it even more. And even now where I'm like, I'm a little heavier than I used to be. But now I like refer to my stomach as like, oh, these are my extra cookies. This is where my extra cookies go. And even though I'd like to have less
delicious.
Who doesn't love cookies?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like celebrating those things. It's like I have a loud laugh, but you know what? It's reassuring to my buddies when they're on stage.
Yeah.
And I take up a lot of space, but I'm also someone who I know that my friends aren't worried about me when I'm in public places because I do take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to like have that shift about how we think about ourselves. And it's so cheesy because it's like the power of thought, but it is so true. Like the ability just to turn it on an edge, and especially in such a vulnerable place of performing and putting your art out there for other people to judge and decide if it's good, you have to be in love with it and really be like, you know what, they might have liked, not have liked it. I'm going to take Amy's idea and say, they just didn't get it. They don't have a clue. And that's okay.
Go figure it out later.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be my advice, is those three things.
Those are good.
Yeah.
Thanks. That's really nice. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me and having this conversation and sharing your thoughts with the podcast.
Oh, it was awesome. So please is punch to be here.
Oh, please is punch.
Please is punch.
All right. Thank you. Everybody have a nice night. And Michelle, Mary Wendell. Thanks. Bye.